right.
All right.
So I guess I will say from writing up the minutes from last time, it wasn't really clear to me where we were starting from or what was supposed to happen after our last meeting. So did people read through the minutes? Does anyone have any updates or comments from last time?
I read through the minutes, and I did put up on, I guess around mid-January, I put up onto the Google Groups the write-up of three of the articles that I had read before about variability, because I said I was going to work on a literature review for that, but I haven't yet kind of synthesized it all. So that still needs to be done. So there's a write-up of the articles just for you all to look through and get a better idea and a shorter version of what the articles on variability were about. But I haven't put it all together yet. So, and I think we were supposed to go back and load up ideas about what do we actually think. We were going to define what is variability, what is distribution, what are the important concepts to know so that we could then build on that to come up with a question. But I went back to the Google Group today and didn't see any movement on that actually from any of us. Has anybody done that?
Not that I posted anywhere, no.
I have not.
No, I haven't either. So we didn't really do what we were supposed to do for this one for these various reasons. Is that what you all had understood that we were supposed to be doing for today?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So we'll call it a bad month.
And I think to get even a little bit more specific, we were going to try to go beyond and just say, instead of variability means this or distributional thinking means this, I think that we wanted to find the components that were necessary, at least in our minds, for understanding sampling distributions. So what is it about the concept of sampling that a student has to get before we can expect them to deal with sampling distributions. So I think we were going to outline that and then find questions.
Mm-hmm. I think you are right.
I know we did a good job with the variability one last month. We had good discussion. And very good minutes, Michael. I was impressed.
It's helpful having the recording to listen through again. So. Can I also have one more update, I guess, before we even get into that? Did everything go through with the JSM submission?
You're talking to Bob?
Either Bob or I guess Tisha was kind of our group's liaison to you.
Oh,
so
okay.
whether it's our group's response or the overall panel or whatever, however we're structuring it?
Well, it's a panel, and then this is new to me, I've never proposed a panel. And what I realized is I really didn't need – actually, the first version I put of the abstract, I kind of had a line in there what each group was going to do. And then I think it was Jennifer Kaplan and Joan Garfield combined in their revisions, suggestions, that kind of became more general what the statement was. And so so that's what's been submitted. I'm not being very clear there, but – Go ahead, Tish.
Oh, I was just going to say that Michelle was asking me when we first started the conversation today,
mm-hmm.
and I have the email that you sent us, Bob. Would you mind if I forward it?
No, you go right ahead.
All right, let me just do that right now. Because it's got the whatever, however many words you were allowed in your abstract.
Right, it's got the abstract, though, right?
Yes.
No, I think 900 characters.
900 characters.
Same as the regular
including
abstract.
Spaces.
I was amazed how fast that goes.
Well, I always go for more, and then I go, how can I say the same thing in one word?
Right.
You know, that's five words, or is this necessary? Mm. But I think it's a rather well formulated statement of it, you know, in the abstract. So I think it's good.
I'm working on it.
So I think, Tisha, you were saying that it sounds like the group, you guys did a pretty good job with variability last time.
Mm-hmm.
And with the idea of saying, what is it about an understanding of variability that's kind of needed or foundational to understand sampling distributions?
Mm-hmm.
And so what other are there other concepts that you guys need to have that same type of discussion about?
Well, another one we have to talk about is distribution.
Okay.
And I think, Tisha, if I remember correctly, on the Google Groups, there are some questions about, you had uploaded some questions about distributional thinking.
Yes.
Didn't you? Let me find, is it research on distributional thinking? Let me see. Because maybe what we could do on that is maybe we can use this time to go forward working on that the way we did on variability last time. Looking through some of the questions. Okay, that's about it.
I have.
Is that the research on distributional thinking?
There's
document?
One I uploaded on, it looks like January 9th, 2007, I think is the date.
Review of questions and a few new submissions.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, that wasn't the total list, but it was at least some that I narrowed it down to, which is maybe.
Okay. I'm going to work on.
Yeah, so it starts off with some of the variability questions that we talked about last time. There we go. Page 4, I guess, is where it starts, distributional thinking.
I was thinking about this a little bit last night. I didn't write anything yet, of course. But I went back and I looked at... Hello?
Hi, it's Dale. I apologize very much for being late. Unavoidable, but here I am.
Welcome.
Glad to have you.
So.
I just sent Dale, if you're wondering, an email that Bob put together an abstract for the JSN panel.
Oh, great.
So everyone should get that.
Great. Great. Thanks.
And we were just talking about the idea of distribution then and what we think students should know.
Uh-huh.
So, again, on your paper, Bob, and with Beth Chance and Joan Garfield, yeah, that table we talked about last time, I think Michael had it in the minutes.
Yep.
The idea of a distribution. And the first thing it says is students should be able to read and interpret graphical displays of quantitative data. So I still have such a hard time with this, but I know it's true that students cannot understand histograms.
And, right.
You know, when I put up a sampling distribution and it's in the form of a histogram, well, they have to know what the x-axis represents and what the y-axis represents. And so on that document that you were all looking at, whatever I called it, had that long title. On page 11, I guess, when I added a couple new questions, one of them was...
Yeah, we've opened up from the Google Groups.
Oh.
Trisha uploaded on January 9th. It's called A Review of Questions and a Few New Submissions.
Great. Okay.
So... Just so you know where we are. Okay, sorry, Tisha, go ahead.
Oh, that's fine. So last night when I was thinking, all right, what is it in terms of distributional thinking that a student has to know? And that first sentence struck me. You know, they have to be able to read and interpret a graph like a histogram. And so on, I guess it's page 11, there was another question I put under for distributional thinking. And I think, Bob, this is from your sampling distribution activity.
Okay.
So it just shows a picture of a histogram, and it says, what do the numbers on the horizontal axis represent? Numbers on the vertical. And I know, to me, that seems very easy, but I wonder if my students, if all of them at least, would agree.
What, if I may comment, what I've seen, I think what we've seen, you know, Joan and Andy and I and some others, is that even after students learn to construct histograms, there are still students who see them as case value plots. And they just want to naturally think in terms of there's a bar for each person. And especially when things aren't labeled and just kind of in the abstract, they want people to be represented on the x-axis, and then the height of each bar is their value. Does that make some sense?
Yeah.
I would say that's definitely
even.
True. Because I have my students do class projects and presentations at the end, and that's not a type of graph that I ever showed them how to create, yet some of them found out on their own how to do it.
Right.
And presented that as part of their project.
Yeah, I've had that happen too. And there's one of the questions that I think it's on a chaos post or pretest, where I think you have batting averages and you have the people across the x-axis and their batting average on the y. and they happen to be in an order where the shape of the height looks like a normal distribution.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That reminds me of that one.
The baseball data, I think.
Yeah, yeah, something
the batting,
like that.
Batting averages data. I'm just going to throw out a question to the group, and that is, so this may all be, this is probably all very true, and we identify students this way, and it may be important for understanding sampling distributions, but is that what's important about understanding distributions with respect to understanding sampling distributions? And I've just been teaching, so I've got to apologize. My Socratic-type questions. So let me be more direct. that maybe that is necessary, that they can actually interpret a histogram correctly. But sampling distributions, to me, has more to do with area under the curve, or that's a big part of an understanding, because that's what motivates p-value. So maybe I'm adding something there. But,
well, I would think, though, that even the basic understanding, because when I think of a sampling distribution, I think I'm looking at it from sort of a simulation point of view. I'm looking at a histogram and thinking that these classes, these widths, are the possible values that X bar can take, let's say, for the sampling distribution of the mean. And so for me, they have to have some feel for the values across that x-axis, or the values that x bar could have, and that's why the range of those is more narrow than the range of individual x values. So I would say that I think it is important, although I think the area under the curve is really important too, but I think that basic step of what does a histogram show you is still pretty important for sampling distribution, I would think.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think having the understanding of what it means, you know, the distribution of means is critical there. And then the areas follow from that, and, of course, they have to have that too. But there are some nice applets I don't have right in my mind in front of me now, but maybe it's from Lane, the one where they show a population at the top. You press a button, and you see a sample drawn, and then you see the mean from that sample go down to a third graph below.
Yeah, that's the Soaker.
Yeah, and if you do that multiple times, it's really clear what that bottom graph, where it's coming from, you know, that you can see these are means, and you can also compare population, sample, and sampling distribution to make that distinction so they don't get confused. And then with a button, you do that 10,000 times or whatever, and you see the shape emerge and all of that. But understanding that it's just that it's means is the critical, and that you never really see it with one sample. I think that's another important concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I use the one at Rice University. I don't know if that's the one that you're talking about.
I think that's the one I'm thinking of, yeah.
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 You know, what's interesting to me in hearing you say this is that if I think about Bob's presentation of the importance of the sample distribution and thinking about area versus Michelle's explanation of thinking about sample means and, you know, taking samples from a population exactly the same way that Dale is describing, there's a transition you have to make between the y-axis being a number, a frequency, and a relative frequency.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the first time that I used that applet from Rice, you know, I hit a button that says draw 1,000 more observations, and my whole graph just changed. And I didn't understand what was going on until I looked at the y-axis and realized that they just changed their scale so it would fit on one page.
Right.
And I wonder whether that's something we need to explore as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, that's actually a little bit of a difference between or maybe a transition between just drawing a histogram and understanding what it means to be a distribution.
Mm-hmm. So understanding what percentiles mean in a distribution is maybe a transition concept, you know, in a histogram type distribution. If you understand percentiles, then as it becomes, you know, smoothed out or whatever, it's a short step to the p-value.
Right.
Well, the idea of, Michael, what you're talking about is from going from the frequency to relative frequency, and a lot of the different things that I read about variability was really the real difficulty that students have in that difference between count data or additive type reasoning and proportional or percentage reasoning, which may be another reason if they're having problems with that. It may be another reason they're having problems making the shift to understanding areas under curves and the kinds of things you're talking about. Again, shifting from count to relative frequency. So maybe we need to add something in there. So I don't know what concept that would go under, but that those two different distinct types of reasoning are both seem to be necessary for understanding sampling distributions.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. In fact, one might introduce confusions if we look at the intermediate steps where we've just generated several different sample means, and one might look at that as saying, well, let's look at proportions or probabilities on that, and that would be quite misleading potentially. We have to make that transition, really address it directly, that transition from relative or from percentiles in a histogram, a discrete distribution, to a continuous. Because a sampling distribution isn't a discrete distribution really at all. The theoretical one, anyway, with a normal. I suppose, digressing, but you can also come at this by looking at different types of sampling distributions where you've got very peculiar populations, and you'd see that, in fact, say, choppy population, say a binomial population, and you draw samples of size 4, there are only certain possible outcomes, and maybe seeing that would be a transitional concept.
Are you thinking because they would be able to track?
Yeah, to see where it's coming from. I really understand what the sampling distribution is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that applet does facilitate some of that.
Yeah.
You can change the starting distribution, and I always find that, I think it's enlightening for the students. I don't know whether they really get it, but, at least the idea for me that the distributions that are closer to normal converge more quickly to a normal distribution. But I think I might be jumping too far ahead.
Yeah. I think it's easy for us to assume that the students see that jump faster than they do.
Sure.
But it seems like we all agree. I mean, one of the things we've also talked about somewhere in this project was what use of technology is helpful, and in particular in what situations. And it seems like we're all using this sampling distribution applet for drawing the sample to facilitate that. So that might be one area where we might want to look just and see. Has anybody, or Bob, you guys did a lot of, that's what you did a lot of was working
mm-hmm.
with the, what was it called, SIMS?
Oh, Sampling Sim.
Sampling Sims.
Yeah, my program. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you kind of had mixed results on that, right? Where sometimes.
But I think we had clear results. that there's still a noticeable number of students who seem to have erroneous understanding, even
right.
after this two sessions, kind of intense immersion into using this program. And it's not just using the program, but it's the activities were quite involved. And quite a few students seem to come along and have a better understanding, but there's still 20 or 30% of the students who weren't demonstrating an understanding of some of the basic ideas from the central limit theorem. Let's put it that way.
Do you think that that's a technological barrier or a content barrier?
What we think it is a an experiential barrier. I don't know if I want to call it a barrier, but the reason is that this is such a foreign way of thinking, or it's information that it's so different than any other information they've ever considered before that they don't have experience with it. So they're really building up their conceptual understanding from the ground up for a noticeable number of students. And so our current approach is you start on day one with drawing multiple samples and making a distribution of sample statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And that they start seeing those over and over again before you actually get to more formal treatment of sampling distributions and inference.
I think one of the biggest challenges for students is with the sampling distribution is that it is so theoretical. It's something you never see. You know, even if you've had a fair amount of experience with distributions, you know, where you actually see the data, you collect it, you plot it out, even theoretical distributions like the normal distribution, you can kind of visualize that as something you could see, you could grab a hold or whatever, but the sampling distribution, you never see.
Uh-oh, sounds like we're turning Bayesian.
I really think so. Reminds me of turning Japanese, I really think so. What we do is, although we do talk about sampling distribution later on in the course, we always just talk about this distribution of the proportions, sample proportions, this distribution of the sample means. And we talk about what percentage are above a certain value, you know, or what would you consider this observed value to be in the tails. That's informally what we do early on. And then we try to formalize it. And then when we get to what we want them to understand about sampling distributions, I don't think we ever really try to get across the idea of a true theoretical sampling distribution. We do more of what are these distributions of actual sample means or proportions? What do they tend to be? And we get more at, you can model them with a normal distribution.
Under some conditions,
yeah. Sure. Under many, but under very robust conditions.
Right. Yeah,
you
right.
know,
I get the feeling of that. Yeah.
Yeah, so it depends on where you want to go, but with the course that we're teaching, the IntroStat course we're teaching, we're more trying to get them to develop the underpinnings of inference and understand p-values. And we're even questioning how important it is for them, for these one time, this is the only stat course they're going to take, consumer level type of statistics course students, how much of the theoretical aspects of a normal of a sampling distribution do they really need to understand to get these big ideas? But I'm not saying that's how everything should go. It's just
that's what I was trying to get at. I think at our last conversation, when I was talking about, you know, do they really need to understand this really well to be able to, you know, have some feel for interpreting output, or they read the newspaper and talk about things being, you know, statistically significant, or I was getting nervous that if you spend too much time in that one course that they get on sampling distributions, they miss a bit of the point of what the use of being able to use statistics in regular, say, quantitative situations, functional quantitative situations. How long have you been teaching it this way, Bob?
You know, this is, and I actually don't teach it. It's our undergraduate course, and Andy's the lead instructor for that, and Andy Ziffler. And we've moved in this direction, started moving in this direction maybe 4 to 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we're actually talking about making some more radical changes for something that might come out in the next 2 or 3 years, where we might not talk about sampling distributions at all. And we
and
might
how,
take.
How are they finding that the students are reacting to it, or that the understanding level is reacting to it?
Well, we really haven't. We've been fine-tuning the curriculum, and we're going to move more into assessment and evaluation actually this semester. So I can't answer that right now. What I think we do have evidence, though, is that we get a better outcome with respect to students understanding p-values. Mm-hmm. That seems to just be part of their everyday language by the time we're about halfway through the course.
With the non-theoretical class you're talking about?
Yeah. Because they've seen these distributions of sample statistics 4 or 5 times by that time, and they've generated them and they've played around with them. There's been questions behind them and that. As far as their understanding of sampling distributions, I think we still see a fair number of students not quite getting certain things. But, you know, we're interested in do they recognize this general form that they tend to see, this normal distribution? Do they understand that across all these samples, that distribution tends to be centered at the population mean, or what we expect for the population mean. But the biggie is, do they understand that as the sample size increases, that distribution of sample statistics tends to become narrower or have lower variability or smaller variance, moving to the more technical. And then can they interpret kind of area beyond a point? Do they start showing this mapping to what eventually becomes the idea of a p-value?
You know, I guess the question that comes up for me right now is how far are we taking the idea of sampling distribution? I think we keep trying to define that boundary between sampling distributions and hypothesis testing. And as Dale said earlier, I actually find that students very often, I think, get hung up on that transition between the theoretical development of sampling distributions into the practical inferential technique of talking about, okay, you have a sample, what do you do with it? And, I mean, again, I think we all think it's straightforward to say, okay, let's think about where that sample falls on that sampling distribution. But that's a real problem for students. And I wonder whether that's a step in the process of learning about this. Maybe it's a step beyond where we want to go right now. But is it a step in the learning process that we would want to consider?
The making the transition?
Yeah, making the transition between, you know, you're developing all this theory about taking a sample a whole bunch of times. Well, you just told me I took a sample a whole bunch of times. Why are you now telling me that I only have one sample?
Right.
You know, and my guess is that students get caught up on that. So I try and spend extra time on it, but I've never really gotten into students' brains enough to really figure out whether they get it or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I always feel like it's a weird transition for me of saying, okay, now that we've developed all this theory, let's talk about how we do it in the real world. You know, in the real world, you don't get sampling distributions.
Right. But you still need to be concerned with, well, I've got my sample, and here's my sample mean, but what are the possible values I might have gotten? You know, if somebody else were to do this, would they get the same number?
Under the null hypothesis.
Yeah, or even under the real world, whatever's out there. You know, whatever's out there, if somebody else replicated, what would they get? Yeah, right, but yeah.
Well, I try to do, I agree with you, they often get caught up on that. And I try to have this drawing that I put up on the board all the time, all throughout the year, where there's a little circle on the left, that's your sample, a big circle on the right, that's your population. And then an arrow from the sample of population. So that's what we really want to do in practice.
Yeah.
We want to draw inferences. But we can't do that until we make a link this other direction. You know, theoretically, if we knew something about the population, what kinds of samples could we get? And so I try to keep coming back to that context all the time. But you're right, they have a really hard time saying, well, why do we have to do that top link arrow from the population of the sample? Can't you just tell us how to do it? it's a tough one.
Are all of you familiar with George or Tishuk? Actually, did I hear your voice a little while ago?
Yeah.
Was there something you were going to say? Or?
Oh, no, go ahead.
Okay. Are you guys familiar with George Cobb?
Mm-hmm.
From Mount Holyoke?
Yep.
And there's an online journal called Ties. I can't remember. Has to do with teaching with statistical education with technology. I think technology for instruction of statistics education or something like that. But it's called TISE. Rob Gould's the editor. And there's been one issue out, and George Cobb wrote or has a published piece in it. And it's basically his address that he gave, his presentation he gave at U.S. COTS two times ago, so I guess 2005. And he basically argues in it, I think is embedded because I've talked with him a few times, he basically argues for a resampling approach to teaching statistics.
Yeah.
And what I was just thinking about is as I'm coming to realize that some people think that that's better for students, and I'm kind of realize that I think part of it is that you always work from one sample. You work from the sample you have. You generate many samples, but it's under an idea of the null hypothesis. But it's still only one sample, and then it's kind of related to what I heard and what Dale was saying. But what are all the possibilities? What else could have happened? And so you generate as many of those as you can, and you compare your observation to that set of possibilities. And then George even says, I don't know if he puts it this way, but in a sense he's saying, I don't even recommend them making a distribution in terms of a graphic representation. All they have to do is list them in order and count. list them in order, find out where their observed value is, how many things are above that, get the proportion, and make a decision.
So and what does he mean by them, list them in order?
So now you've generated all these possible samples, and they've got some statistic that you're calculating from all of them. And so basically make a table, which is a representation of the distribution, but make a table of them, sort it, like a frequency distribution, or a frequency table. Find out where your observed value is and decide whether it's extreme or not.
I think there's a lot of appeal to that. You know, the real advocates of it say, you know, it will supplant a lot of what we do. What we're doing in essence is generating the sampling distribution empirically.
Well, yes and no. It's still empirical, uh-huh. and you don't necessarily, depending on the size of the sample, you don't necessarily come up with all possible combinations or all possible permutations.
Well, and you also happen to be more susceptible to any outliers that happen to be in your sample,
yeah,
by random chance.
Yep. Yeah, it has its caveats, right?
I mean, but then again, so does the traditional, you know, one-sample t-test or something.
Mm-hmm. I was just responding more to that comment of yours, Michael, that you started off of, students do get hung up on this thing of, there's two things I know they get hung up on. So now why are we only talking about one sample when we've been generating all these samples? Why don't we just do that? And they don't get that that's not the real world, that we've been trying to do something hypothetical or theoretical. And then the other thing is they get hung up on thinking, so the number of samples matters. Not
right.
Just sample size, but actually there's something that kind of bleeds over for this number of samples thing.
The terminology sample gets us in trouble there sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they think a sample, is that like one case, or is that, so the language, I think, sometimes.
Yeah. And I've seen many mathematical writings where the sample means one case.
Yeah.
I sample. I repeatedly sample. And they're talking about one draw.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's on our list of misleading terms, things that mean something special in statistics.
Michael, when you made that comment earlier, I think you asked a question with it. Maybe I heard wrong, but... I'm going to ask the question, if you hadn't already, have we drawn that line when we talk about, at the end of this, what we want students to get out of sampling distributions? Is part of it being able to recognize that maybe my sample mean is an unusual value based on what this distribution of sample means looks like? Or are we stopping at just, we want them to understand the concept of a sampling distribution?
I would have a preference to go this a step further. Which is that's where I thought that when we first met at USCUTS, we were all kind of interested in p-values and hypothesis testing. We had started doing some reading with that, and then we kind of went back a little bit and said, well, to get this, they have to understand more about sampling distributions. But I would be interested in trying to make eventually that link down the road towards understanding unusual values and
so
eventually,
when we start to get our list of questions together, that's one thing that we're going to be wanting to investigate from the students then, in terms of sampling distribution understanding.
Well, what do you guys
think,
Mike and Dale? I would like to go that far if we can.
I think it would be really useful for us to give some thought to it. Exactly what is it that we want students to be able to do with this. And, you know, we've got some maybe this overall kind of global deal about the whole thing, but what is it that we want our students to, what do they need is one thing, mm-hmm. I suppose. And here it seems like the answer depends on what the goals are for the students. You know, if this is the first course in a series where they're going to go on and do research and so forth, graduate course or things, it's a different goal. Are we clear on what our target student is?
I guess I wasn't convinced, I guess, that we're framing towards a target student. So I agree. I mean, I think we all ultimately want to go towards hypothesis testing and making those kind of inferences. And I recall a similar conversation as Michelle stated that, you know, we wanted to go towards that, but maybe we should kind of stop at sampling distribution because maybe we're biting off a little too much at the beginning. But in terms of what Dale said, I mean, I think perhaps one of the uses of this type of research might be to actually compare different types of students. And so that perhaps we're not targeting one type of student, but saying, you know, for example, if we show that there's no correlation between understanding variability and the normal distribution, students can still make appropriate inferences from a single draw from a population, as in doing a hypothesis test, then maybe that's stronger evidence towards, you know, what George Cobb is saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas if we show that, you know, students who don't understand variability and the idea of a distribution really don't get that concept of hypothesis testing, if we could do that, you know, even in a class that took the resampling framework, that might be interesting. And again, I often wind up being too outcome-based. You know, if we can show this and if we can show that, and I don't want to, you know, jump too far ahead, but I mean, for me, that always helps kind of keep my eye on the task.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm inclined to push it toward hypothesis testing, too, because, I mean, after all, that's where we're going with it. You have to make decisions. You're using data to make decisions, and understanding the concepts are important, but it does raise that question of can you be successful with making decisions and without some of the or still living with some of the misconceptions or without understanding some of the basics.
So I think for me, myself, when I think about all this, so we're going to have questions on variability, and we talked about that last time and came up with questions that we all said, oh, yeah, you know, that test what my student should understand before they can move on to sampling distributions. And I think I'll be able to come up with some questions about just sampling in general that I, again, think students should be able to answer before they can move on. And I think we're all going to agree just fine on questions that test their understanding of sampling distributions. I am stuck on distributional thinking. And I don't know if part of it is because of, again, this thing where it's just so hard to separate distributional thinking from variability and sampling distribution. I don't know.
So I've been sitting here staring at the definition from that page 300 of the Chance Delmasson
mm-hmm.
Garfield book. And one of the things that it says at the end is students should be able to see between the data and describe the overall shape of a distribution and be familiar with common shapes such as normal, skewed, uniform, or bimodal. Is that something that's important for us? I don't know if I just took it on a tangent separate from what Fisher was saying.
No, that's exactly what I was asking.
No, I think you're right on the right same wavelength there.
I mean, so the complete few sentences that they have, students should be able to read and interpret graphical displays of quantitative data and describe the overall pattern of variation. This includes being able to describe distributions of data, characterizing their shape, center, and spread, and being able to compare different distributions on these characteristics. And then they should be able to tell the shapes, including normal, skewed, uniform, and bimodal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do think it's important because I think when you get to talking about trying to read a histogram and things like that. I'm trying to think in terms of real life type data. Anything financial, you should understand something about fat tails and that it's not, you know, I can have this nice normal distribution where you talk about returns. I'm taking an online class right now on statistical process control and learning a lot about, you know, what kinds of actual manufacturing distributions real data is chosen from and why it makes your control charts inappropriate if you have skewed data. So I feel like, yeah, the shape of the data, the shape of the distribution really does matter. It has real implications for trying to make decisions about something based on the data. So I would tend to think that was pretty important.
Yeah, I'd agree. And, but, you know, even just the vocabulary is important for you to talk about these things in the way that you can actually, you know, what you have. But having this sensitivity to the, you know, outlier skew and so forth is really important. You know, sometimes I think students come away thinking everything should be normal or that everything's normal and anything that's not in the normal is just an error or something.
I was just going to say, to the extent possible, I think questions, I don't particularly like questions that are devoid of all context. Things where you're just looking at, you know, VARF, there's one here I've got up here on page, this page 2 of the sheet that we all opened. The first one where you're just looking at VAR 5 and VAR 6, I think when you talk about the shape of data, if the data has some kind of meaning, it's much easier to understand why shape is important because of the implications that it has on any eventual decisions or any understanding that you'd actually be making of this data. So I don't know how you feel about this, but for questions that we include, try to make sure that there's some sort of context to what we're talking about that makes it a bit more understandable. What do you think?
I think that helps an awful lot. We've all seen, you know, people who say, now I finally understand when I've got my own data, or I collect data and I've got my, you know, some concrete example that they can get a handle on, rather than just, but at the same time, you know, I think people who really understand it can extend it out. Possibly testing whether people understand things or not, one can test the more abstract, but for teaching it, probably more concrete is better.
I think what, Michelle, what you're suggesting is almost verbatim of what the GAES guidelines suggest, that we shouldn't be using naked data. You know, and I think unless the purpose of the question, as Dale was saying, is to remove the context and see if they can make the inference, that giving them context is helpful.
And Bob here, I'm just going to add that, yeah, I think if you're testing for certain concepts, it might be legitimate to be a little tricky. And that much might involve not labeling axes and not giving a context, but certainly you wouldn't want. But I think you're right. The majority of times you want it to be in a context that helps them make sense of it. So just to try to add that it's legitimate sometimes to not have a context there because of what you're trying to assess.
But even so, I would actually I absolutely agree with that, and I found I forget who had suggested it, but I did a great example, again, what I thought was a great example, who knows what the students thought, in class testing whether students understood how to read box plots and histograms by giving them data without any axes labeled at all. And so one of the variables was the year in which each State of the Union was founded. So all it was numbers that were like in the 1800s and 1900s, and students had to look at it by looking at the numbers themselves and the distribution. They had to figure out what the data were. And it was a really fascinating exercise that generated some great discussion. And there was another one of, you know, average age of people on a parent-teacher day in school. And so it was a nice bimodal distribution of all the kids, but then the parents as well, and a couple older siblings in there, you know, thrown in for extra noise. but you don't give them any labels. It was a great exercise.
What I like about that type of exercise is it gets it can get students thinking about how data is produced, processes that are behind it. If I'm tracking what you're saying, so if you tell them here's the name of a variable and you show them a bunch of data, you say which set of data represents that variable. Is that the idea, Michael?
Yeah.
Then sometimes when I've done this, I've gotten them into discussions. Why would the data set that you're saying represents this variable? Why would that be it? Why would data of that variable have that distribution or look like those numbers? And it tree heights in certain forests, you know, I don't know. What do you think are the factors that influence the height of these trees, and why do you think you'd have that distribution? What did we do one time in one of our items? Wrist circumference of newborn female babies.
Yes. Yeah, there's questions like that where there's a kind of a context, and there's a bunch of graphs, and say which one of these could be appropriate for this context for this. Mm-hmm. Type of data, yeah. I agree with that. I like this.
Yeah. I mean, I would just say in terms of the question that Michelle's pointing out, and then I'll stop talking because I feel like I've done a lot now. The histogram labeled, quote, var5, that feels like, you know, a 1980s computer programmer language. You know, and so maybe just being a little less techy 30? About it, maybe, if you will, saying, you know, these two histograms present two variables, you know, one of which has a mean of 54, or variable A at least, instead of var 5 and var 6.
Yeah.
Because those just feel a little, you know, off-putting to some people.
Yeah. And everybody, I apologize. Actually, I stayed on later than I intended to, so I've got to run, and which means you guys will probably be much more productive in the last few minutes of your conversation here.
Bob, do you want to stay on for a minute and have us pick a time for the next meeting before you go, or do you have to rush?
I got to walk a mile and a half before 5:30 to go teach karate. So a minute, yeah, I can stay on. Let's do it, if that's okay with everybody else.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. 4 weeks from today is March 4, but that's just the starting point. We did Thursday as another option earlier, but maybe Tuesday's better.
Doesn't make much difference.
That week is not great for me.
Tuesday's fine with me, too. March 4?
Yeah, that week's my spring break.
Oh, okay. What about?
I haven't figured out plans yet.
What about the week after?
The week after, I'm supposed to be at a graduate open house on Tuesday night, but other nights would work for me. Either Monday or Thursday, the 10th or 13th is good.
Either works for me.
Yeah.
Either works for me.
Okay. Monday would have to be, I think I have something that goes till 5 out of my building, so it'd be like 5:30 Central, which is going to make it late for, that'll make it late for Michelle, right?
Yeah, that's a little late for me.
So what does Thursday look like for you, Bob?
It's my same teaching schedule. I'm done at 3:45 Central, so I can get to a call about 4 o'clock, 5 p.m. Eastern.
I can do that.
Is everybody else okay with that?
Yep.
I can. I got office hours, but I can use those.
So this is Thursday. What's the date?
The 13th.
13th.
Thursday, 13th of March at 5 Eastern?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
5 Eastern.
Okay.
Pacific.
Thanks, Bob.
You're welcome. Thank you, guys.
Okay.
And great talking with you guys again.
Thanks. You too.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye. Hello?
Yep. I'm still here. Yeah. So what more do we need to do here yet? I guess think about what were steps for next time, maybe, huh?
Yep.
I think
we've kind of been dragging a little bit. We said before you came on, Dale, we were talking about that none of us really did much for over this last month for what we were planning on doing.
Well, I'm right with you there.
I have a little bit more time this coming month than I have in the past 2 months, so
all right.
I'm happy to step up and take some of it.
Well, what do you see as the next things that we ought to focus on?
I think we're getting closer to focusing in on what we really want to test and getting those questions. I think the sooner we can get questions together and then distributed to some students, we're going to start to have so much more to talk about with some preliminary data.
Yeah.
I guess I was kind of thinking we had talked about defining, you know, exactly what each point is in those four prerequisites.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if maybe we shouldn't do that simultaneously with writing the questions, so that for each question, we try and be extremely specific about what it addresses.
Right.
And that might be a way to both move us forward at a little bit faster pace, but also, you know, kill two birds with one stone.
Right.
Excellent suggestion.
Yep.
So do we want to go back to setting up an intermediate goal before our next conference where we go back and say, okay, let's sharpen up some of these questions and kind of divide it up into different topics. Each of us try to come up with, you know, say four or five questions related to a certain topic and then comment them on the Google groups.
The document that we've been looking at today, we all put questions up, and I know at least two people have put their comments up on it.
Mm-hmm.
TH, I assume that's Tisha. DB, is that Michelle?
That's
Dale. I thought Michelle had her comments this way. Yeah. So it looks like Tisha and Dale have commented on all of the questions up there.
Warning, though. I took subsets of what everyone. Dale commented on all of Michelle's questions. I only commented on a few of them, and the ones that I commented on are what I put in this document.
I see.
And so there are more out there. Just so we're all aware of that. I just didn't want this thing to be 50 pages long.
Right.
Which maybe it should have been. That might have been better to keep them all together.
Well, it depends on what the task at hand is. So so I wouldn't mind taking, you know, a little bit of time and kind of going through stuff. And, you know, maybe based on the comments that I see from Dale and Tisha, and maybe going back to the other document and grabbing them to kind of start assembling a document that has, you know, the first draft of a couple questions, as well as identifying what specific topics they address.
That would really move us forward, I think, if you could take a shot at it, and then, you know, other people could kick in other questions yet if something's left out or can comment on to improve the questions and so forth.
Right.
But that, I think that would be an efficient way to go.
Okay. So I'm happy to offer that.
So great if next time we all talked, we actually had a list in advance.
Yeah.
And our conversation was, we did good.
That would be great.
Now, it works when we send messages to the list, over, we get the message. I guess I haven't gone to our Google site very often. If we put stuff up there, it may sit there for a while without noticing it.
Yeah, I'll plan on sending an email out
when
anything substantial is up there.
Okay, I didn't send an email out when I put on my notes up last time, so I'll do that too for anything we put up.
Helpful.
And Michael, I'll do that too because I haven't gone back. When I put together the original questions, I just kind of threw a whole bunch of them together without a lot of reflection. So it's not that there may be some here that have comments that are negative. Let's just get rid of them. The ones that say this doesn't really, it's hard to say with this test.
Okay.
So we can cut that list down, and I'll go back and look at some of the good ones, some of the ones that Tisha and Dale had more positive things to say about and comment them as well. One question I had for you all about, are we supposed to have a literature review together basically by the end of this, by JSM? Was it more or less we were trying to do that over the first year?
I think that was their goal, yes.
Okay. Well, what I can try to do, because Tisha, you've put up some notes on the distributional thinking articles that you wrote. And I've put up some notes on some of the variability. And since they're very, very closely related, maybe what I can work on over the next month is trying to meld that together somewhat to get a first sort of rough draft of at least those two concepts.
Okay, and I'd be happy to help, too, with the distributional thinking part of it, too, because I don't think I've done a very good job with the notes I have up there of melding anything together either.
Well, that's what I had neither. It was more just, okay, this is what this article says, and so now there needs to be a synthesis process.
Yeah.
Is there a kind of a deliverable goal that we're shooting for? Are we supposed to publish a literature review or at least submit a literature review? Are we supposed to just use this as a foundation for, you know, another future publication? Are we just doing it to practice writing literature reviews?
Well,
it's a great question to ask when none of the RAB members are there. So.
Certainly the latter option would not be my goal.
Well, I think we'll all agree on ruling that one out. Great.
But I think if it would be, I mean, I would certainly be interested in trying to publish a literature review on these concepts that we think possibly precede understanding sampling distributions. And then I would hope in the long run the goal would be then that this would be a literature review for kind of a paper on our results. This is what
right.
we thought, this is what we did, and this is what we found.
I do remember Bob or Joan or somebody saying that, yes, people can think about publishing their lit reviews. That's a midway point, you know.
Right. But at minimum, it would be something that would be useful as we work on, you know, the research on collecting data or whatever, trying to interpret and see what other people have done in the area.
I'm finding that, you know, if I it's getting to be back in my mind, you know, I'll read something, I think it's interesting, we'll talk about it, and then I don't get back to it for another month, 2 months, 3 months,
yep.
and I have to go back through the whole process. So I feel like, you know, it's been about 9 months since we started, that it would be useful to consolidate some of what we've read and understood so far.
Right.
What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think so. Another positive step is we can start doing some of that. That'll help us also figure or determine what more we need to do to round things out.
Right. I mean, I guess I'd also like to start thinking about kind of, you know, what is our, you know, year from now goal and time frame and what needs to happen in order to get there. I mean, I have no idea whether we're moving at a fast pace, slow pace. It doesn't feel that fast to me, but.
No.
I'd say slow. I'd say we started off pretty fast, and it's been slowing down a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But I feel like we are reaching a little bit more clarity, though.
Right, and having some of these products, I think, will help sharpen that even more.
And I don't know what everyone else's impression was from the conference call that we had with all of the research clubs. My impression is that we are not lagging behind other groups.
Right. I got that impression, too. Yeah.
Oh, I'm embarrassed to say I still haven't listened to it.
That's okay. I don't remember a whole lot from it either. So.
Yeah. But if we can come up with some actual, you know, questions that we can work with and try and get some data where we can, you know, just some pilot data trying out with students and to see how these work, that will move us, that will help us a lot, I think, moving forward.
Yeah, I think
yeah, I think that's where the priority should be.
And I think we keep talking about coupling it with the idea of hypothesis testing, and I think it's great to, we have a resource in Sharon Lane Gitesse's RPAS. So that might be a nice, easy way of saying, let's only go as far as sampling distributions in terms of creating something, and then when we implement it, you know, give people the RPAS as well and just, you know, kind of look to see what we find.
Mm-hmm.
Big bang,
like
little buck.
So, shall we try to set an intermediate date to get some of these questions up there so that we look at it before we meet next time?
I think that'd be wise, yeah.
Sure.
Because if we're looking at the 13th of March, Where's Heather? I don't have my calendar in front of me.
Maybe 3 weeks, something like that.
Yeah,
that sounds good. So Thursday and Friday are research days for me. I've officially blocked them out of my do-anything teaching calendar.
Good for you.
So maybe if we can think about by, like, Thursday or Friday, I guess, like, the 21st, 22nd, I can definitely target by then to get something up on the website.
Okay.
Maybe even the week before, but...
I'm on vacation from the 16th to the 23rd, so I'll either have something up before the 16th or after the 23rd.
All right.
So, okay.
Okay.
Okay, well, that sounds good.
Yeah, and then when we, right, when we get that up there, we can each contribute to it, try some of these things out. And I think we'll probably have plenty to talk about then next time.
Mm-hmm. How long do you all have class still? Because if we want to get some student data, we need to get at least to get an initial feel for the kinds of problems we run into with the questions. We need to make sure we can administer something before the end of the term. When do you all have school till?
Finals are the first week in, well, I guess it starts last week in April, first week in May here.
Okay.
I think I'm into the second week in May.
I think my schedule is the same as Tisha's, except that, remember, I'm only teaching graduate classes this semester, but I can definitely try and touch base with some other faculty members and see if they can do some of the data gathering for me.
Okay. And I finish one term at the end of March, and then I have a April, May, June term. So I finished July 4th, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we still have some. We still have a possibility of getting some student data in. Okay, that's good.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I guess we will have different options here.
I mean, it's actually it's a good question, because I think that maybe what we need to do is, you know, think about gathering student data, even if it's not a finished product yet.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think just even sitting down with a few students and having them talk it through can be enlightening, too. That
right.
Doesn't have to necessarily be a big data collection.
Right, right. So, good.
So perhaps our goal for the next one is that we get something usable together, and then maybe the goal for the one after that is that, to the extent possible, using whatever students, you know, different ones of us have available, to try to collect a bit of data so that we have something to discuss for the one after that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not teaching an undergraduate class either, but some of my students are, so I might be able to track down something. But yeah, and I like the idea of, we talked earlier too about talking things through with students and having them think aloud, make notes, and, you know, answer why and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Any more depth.
I need to get going.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, me too.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's a pleasure. And again, I'm sorry I was late, but it was good catching up with you folks.
Me too.
You too.
And just remind me one thing. When this gets recorded, where do we go to listen to it again?
Jane Scott will send out a link, I think, maybe to me, and then I'll forward it to you.
Okay, super. Thanks a lot.
Yep.
Talk
Thanks,
to
everyone.
You next month.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
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 Good night. Bye.
Thank you. Please.